another problem we have with it and still have with the Indian administration is that so many things are the landed property of the tribe is held in the name of the United States in trust. And then the Congress charges the Secretary of the Interior with the responsibility of exercising that trust. Therefore, over the years, there are certain rules and regulations that have established for the protection or the exercise of that trust. Every honest effort, I think, designed to protect the Indians in the use of the and use and of their property. And so the Constitution, as it was written, in every section almost, says with the approval of the Secretary of the Interior, or with the review of the Secretary of the Interior, and if he doesn't turn it down within a certain period of time, it becomes effective. And the old dealer, so-called, said, well, you see, I told you, the Secretary's still going to have control. He's having control. You've got to go to him. The newer one said, well, this is, of course, necessary under the circumstances, but then at some point, when they tried to move beyond what the law would permit and the Secretary would step in to prevent its completion of the enactment carried into force, well, then they would begin to get chafing at the bit, feeling that they were unnecessarily restrained. There were provisions in the Constitution by which after a certain period, in some instances, the Secretary's authority would expire and so on, but never was there any authority in the Constitution where the Secretary's trust over responsibility was completely taken away. And of course it couldn't be, because if the Indians are to keep their land in trust subject are not subject to local taxation, why then it would have to be considered, at least in a sense, a kind of federal property, because it would be in the name of the United States being held in trust. Well, and so there was this feeling that the tribal councils did not get enough authority to really do the things they wanted to do on behalf of the people they represented. And then we had, along with this, then also this federal charter of incorporation. Now that again created a lot of difficulty for the old timers, because the charter authorized the tribe to accept gifts and property, and also to hypothecate tribal property for any loans that they may get from the federal government. Well, this those who are opposed said, well, here's a group of people that are governing our people. They're a small group. They weren't representing all of the people. And the older people didn't think they were being represented adequately. So there's a great deal of feeling about the acceptance of the charter that this would cause them to lose the land. And if they borrowed the money, the federal government would come along later on. And if they won a claim, this would be an offset against the claim. There are many things like that. Ghost was raised against it that they could imagine, and some of it had just enough fact to it to give it a color of truth, and I can understand their apprehensiveness in this regard.
Well, they beat it. They beat it at Pine Ridge. They beat it at Pine Ridge, didn't they?
No, the law was accepted at Pine Ridge. The Constitution,
no,
charter was all.
The charter, they didn't. The corporate charter, they didn't take.
Maybe they didn't take the corporate charter. I guess at Rosebud, they took all three. I think that probably was true. Lower Brule accepted all three. Coal Creek didn't accept anything. Standing Rock accepted the law, but never got a constitution or a charter. Cheyenne River accepted all three, as I recall. And probably Pine Ridge, I guess, maybe the charter. If you check the reason, it's been so long ago.
Is that charter a real advantage? I still hear people out of Pine Ridge especially argue against that, you know.
Well, I think it would be an advantage, the charter makes it possible for the tribe to borrow this money at, I think it was 2 or 3% interest, I've forgotten. The tribe could borrow it and then re-lend it to the members on the reservation, or of the tribe under certain circumstances. And I have had the feeling that if you had a group of people who are attuned to our open-ended society with a capitalistic system as its economic base, where you have all of this property, say at Pine Ridge, with the quite a lot of tribally owned lands, with the business opportunities at the Indian Agency, and the livestock possibilities, if they could get out and take this charter and borrow all they could get from the federal government that the law would permit, and people willing to go along with the interest rate that is the most reasonable of any in the country, except maybe some of our loans in foreign countries, that a corporation of that kind with these economic advantages, non-taxability and many other things, they would be an advantage over most any other non-Indian organization in that part of the country. Cheyenne River has attempted to go in this direction to some extent with their store, for instance. A tribal store and telephone system. They have a tribal telephone system. There are a lot of things that the tribe could do in this regard, but of course you have the problems of the traditions of the people, the at best the opportunities on a reservation, even if you could really move with an optimum speed with no obstacles, doesn't provide sufficient economic opportunities to keep the aggressive individual there. So what's happening, as you probably are aware, is that as fast as our school systems get them educated, and they go on to college and they develop the skill or profession that is in demand, very seldom they go back to the reservation unless they can get a job in the government, in the public health service, division of Indian health, or in one of the church organizations or in one of the other federal or state programs. But any that have any opportunity that are better than those, they're gone. And
of course, this tends to be true of the white communities.
Yes,
something
that you have, say, in South Dakota, let's take for example. Back in the 30s, when this program started, we had about 90,000 farm units, and that's dwindled down to a little over 50,000. And the farmers and ranchers remain are the most capable ranchers. Mm-hmm. Those who were on the fringe and couldn't succeed and were too small migrated out. So you have the reverse situation in Dakotas. Mm-hmm. I think in the rural areas, the keener business there. Now, there is presently, because of lack of economic opportunities, a lot of these young, the children of these people are beginning to leave.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still staying there on those ranches, some of the very best and capable young men and women. But this is not so of this Indian group who have a entirely different cultural pattern. And so what we have on our Indian reservations today, in my judgment, is a residuum of everything that can't succeed someplace else. Because if they could, they would leave. If you look over any family out on the Dakotas, with a few exceptions, some have taken on ranching, a few have gotten into government service, a few have gotten some little businesses started, but by and large, anyone with any drive sees the better opportunity someplace else, they disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So this makes it an extremely difficult situation on the reservation, and the Indian Reorganization Act is really a part, and what and the Constitution and the Charter were really, facilitating agencies for economic and social development, both of which come extremely slow in an Indian community where you're continually draining off the more aggressive, less conservative mind about us concerned. I mean, willing to change.
Right.